Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. It's called lifestyle inflation. When we earn more, we often want more and buy more. But that doesn't always make us feel fulfilled. Sometimes, to use the cliche, less is more. That's the idea behind author Kate Flanders' new memoir, The Year of Less. We'll talk to her about how consuming less could make you happier. Then, you've heard of home sharing apps like Airbnb, but did you know there also is an app that helps you rent out your car? It's called Turo, and it's a neat idea, but I don't know if it'd be for me, partly because I'm afraid someone might wreck my car, and partly because I don't want them to judge the crumbs they will find in between the seats. We're going to speak with Turo's Cedric Mathieu. And millennials may have decades to save for retirement, but that doesn't mean they should just invest in any old mutual fund and forget about it. More time may mean paying more investment fees for longer. And a lot of that can be avoided. We'll talk about the compounding effect of mutual fund fees with Steve Bridge from Money Coaches Canada. Plus, building the family bank. High net worth families have complex financial affairs and sometimes need more than just an accountant to sort it all out. Managing a large amount of wealth can be a business in and of itself, which is why some families have something called a family office. We'll learn more from Emily Griffiths Hamilton. And we'll talk about investing in cannabis with entrepreneur Renee Ellison. She quit her job at Health Canada to launch Flourish, a cannabis company devoted to women's health and awareness. All that's ahead. Let's get started. A shopping ban. No buying clothing, electronics, books, furniture, or even takeout coffee for an entire year. Impossible, you say? Well, Kate Flanders actually went out and did it. And then she wrote a very compelling memoir about her experience called The Year of Less. She joins us now from Squamish, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello.
Kate, I read a lot of personal finance books, like a lot, so I do not say this lightly. Yours is an extraordinary book. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's like it's a completely different experience from 99% of the books that I read. When did you decide that this was a memoir and not a traditional, you know, how to, three tips to, dot, dot, dot?
I mean, I think I knew right from the start that it had to be a memoir. And that's also just based on the way that I write my blog. I've never written a lot of how-to kind of posts. And so even though over the years I've obviously learned a ton about money and I probably could give some advice, I just have always shared my personal experiences with it. And so I always knew that that's what the book had to be.
What was different for you about this being a book versus a blog? I mean, it's personal. Your parents' divorce, your breakups, your drinking, like all of these kinds of things you lay bare here. How did that feel?
It was so much different than writing a blog post. It was actually an interesting thing to realize, even just getting started. Like with a blog post, you sort of present a problem and offer maybe ideas and a solution like within 1500 words. And with the book, you're like not allowed to start fixing it until like word 50,000. It was really just like creatively a very interesting challenge because you can't get to the point. You have to keep telling stories. And so it was really, really different. I think the reason I'm so grateful that I was like just had the chance to write this is because I don't know that I ever would have shared those things on the blog, and certainly not in the detail that I did in the book. And that's truly just because I had more space. Like I had the space to write more.
We talked to a lot of people who have issues around spending, but typically the things they describe are, you know, I buy too many clothes or I bought too big of a house or something. One of the issues that you call out for yourself was breakups. And you lay out in fascinating detail about the spending that followed a particular breakup. What would you say you learned about yourself as you put this to paper?
Oh, my gosh. I think, like right off the bat, something I realized was, okay, like to backtrack it, when I did this experiment, I was already debt-free. But that was kind of the first thing I'd written about on my blog. And so I paid off the debt in 2 years. The other thing I did in those 2 years was I quit drinking. I decided I had a really unhealthy relationship with alcohol and I just needed to not have it in my life. Mm. So something I realized that year, especially with things like the breakup, was that in the past, I would have numbed myself probably with drinking. And because drinking wasn't an option, like I knew I would not drink. It was almost then I realized like the next easiest thing to go to was emotional spending. And so I don't think I had ever identified myself as that before, like an emotional spender. But that year I really realized like by having sort of the restriction of you are not allowed to buy things unless you need it. I really had to start listening to kind of the stories I was telling myself, how I was feeling as a consumer and like in those moments, and had to stop myself. So I definitely realized I was, a lot of my transactions in the past were much more emotional.
What was the hardest element of the shopping ban to follow through on? I mean, some of these things you're allowed to shop for cleaning products, gifts for others, groceries, no electronics, household items, and then a very short list of approved items like one outfit for multiple weddings. As you reflect on that time, what was like, oh, it's fine, didn't really miss it, and what was, oh my God, I can't believe I had to do that?
Okay, so the easiest thing, and this is what I'll say just off the bat, is that it would be different for everybody. Mm. For me, the easiest thing was clothes, because I realized, like, right at the start, I've literally always been someone who wears, like, the same three outfits in a week. And if I'm really honest, I probably wear the same thing most days.
And you work in a field where that's socially acceptable. It's not horrifying.
Totally. And so I just really realized that right off the front, and like shopping for clothes has never been an interest of mine. So that was super easy. Didn't miss it. Never thought about it. Clothes to me were always like very practical. You have what you need, the end. It was really hard in the beginning, I will say, to change habits. And so it's actually interesting. I did an interview with someone and I was like, one of the hardest things to give up was actually takeout coffee. And they laughed at me. And I'm like, no, you don't get it. Like, it's not that it's takeout coffee.
Yeah.
That is something I did every single day, basically, and I wasn't allowed to.
Mm. It's almost like giving up brushing your teeth or something.
Yeah, like,
that's like motor memory, like muscle memory. You just do it without thinking.
Totally. And so every single day for like, it took a couple months, really. Like every single day you're facing that moment of, oh, I want to do this thing and I'm not allowed. And so the hardest part was absolutely changing habits.
I talk a lot. I think a lot. I write a lot about the emotional undercurrent that connects to everyone's very individual relationship to money as a tool and also how we improve our habits. You do as well in a very, very personal way. What have you heard from your readers? Have you found that people are opening up to you in new ways because of the things that you have shared?
Well, I think like one of the coolest things about the book is just that it has brought in a whole bunch of new readers I never would have connected with before. So I'm hearing from a lot of people for the very first time. They had no idea I had ever written a blog or anything, and they just picked up the book and read it. So I think some of the most common things I'm hearing are lines in there about how I used to shop for a more aspirational version of myself, mm-hmm. people realizing that they didn't even realize that's what they were doing, but they completely related to it. Things about definitely just the emotional spending. And then also reasons why it was hard to let go of some stuff. Like I also kind of decluttered and got rid of a lot of things. And so people relating to that as well, of just, especially the ones around like, oh, I spent money on this at one point, like I have to keep it.
Mm.
So there's been a big mix, but I would say that the one I hear over and over is the aspirational or like ideal version of myself, people right. not realizing that they were shopping for that person.
We talk a lot about the fear of missing out in today's culture, exacerbated by the images that we see on social media and things like that. If you're not out there shopping, you know, on top of the latest clothing trends or the newest iPhone, did you experience FOMO or was that so far beyond something that would suck you in at that point?
It's a good question. I don't really remember having it maybe around shopping. I think I had more interesting discussions with friends where I realized like I almost couldn't even partake in their conversations anymore. Mm-hmm. Like if friends started talking about deals they got or something they purchased for their home or whatever, I more went back to that feeling of like I'm the only sober person in the room.
Right.
And I have nothing to add to this. So I would say more so I did have feelings like I just wasn't or I couldn't be part of some conversations. But there wasn't really anything that I felt like I missed out on.
What would you say the transition has been like as a as an emotional consumer, a binge consumer, to a mindful consumer, a phrase that I lift from your words?
I would say that, like, if we talked about habits, because I said that was the hardest thing for me to change, the biggest one I've realized, and sometimes I hate that I called it a shopping ban, because it just, it sounds so restrictive. And when I really think about what I was doing that year, it's that I basically did more like a browsing ban. Like, I had to stop browsing. So browsing meaning literally, like, you walk into a store, you're like, well, I'll just walk around, like, I might find something.
And why did you need to stop browsing? Was it that because those two were inextricably linked for you?
Because browsing almost always ended up in a purchase. Like, for me, my thought now is, like, if you go out looking for and saying, like, I might find something, you're going to find something that you can buy. And the problem with that is that you're talking yourself into needing it rather than actually feeling the need first. And I had never done that before. I had never just, like, lived without something and then thought, like, felt that need, like, oh, okay, this is really annoying. I should buy this little thing that will make this situation better. I had never actually done that. So now shopping for me is so transactional. I've actually been in moments where it's like, okay, this is something I genuinely need. I will figure out where to get it. I go get it and I'm out. Like, it's just a transaction. There's nothing emotional about it.
We said that it was more memoir than tips, but you do at the end of the your book have your guide to less. And one of the tips is around lists, writing three lists. Tell us about the essentials list, the non-essentials list, and the approved shopping list.
Okay, so if anyone was going to do something similar to this, then I would say writing the list is just a really helpful exercise to do even before you get started. So for me, essentials were just like the things you use in your regular life. So the things you use on a daily basis, like toothpaste and deodorant, like when you run out of those things, everyone wants you to buy more of it. So, like, essentials are the things you use all the time. I also had things like just groceries and putting gas in my car. Like, all of that stuff was okay. And like you said, I was allowed to buy gifts for others. People ask me a lot of questions around that. And I'm like, if you don't want it to affect other people, buy gifts. Like, that's right. Totally fine. For me, it was always about, like, not wanting to bring more stuff into my own home unless I needed it. So the essentials list, what you use regularly. The non-essentials, so the stuff that you're not allowed to buy, unless you're in some kind of situation where, like, you absolutely have to replace it. So for me, that list was long, like clothes, shoes, accessories, books, magazines, electronics, like you mentioned a bunch of them in the beginning. Mm. And that list is, like, unless something came up, and which a couple little things did happen that year. Like, I had to replace my one pair of jeans, and my cell phone literally died to the point that it would never turn on again.
Right.
So at that point, yes, like, go out and make a conscious purchase. And it's not emotional or keeping up with trends or anything. It's like, I physically need this. Then
yeah.
You go make
I don't have a landline. This isn't a pleasure tool. I need something. I have one last question I want to ask, and that is, what's next for you? I mean, it's such an inspiring tale. It's so compelling to hear where you have been. Where are you headed?
Great question. I mean, like, career fun. What's exciting is the book has done really well, and so the option to do another book is there. But personally, like, it's been interesting. I've been finding that I'm really fascinated just sort of with the topic of consumption as a whole. Mm. And so not just about, like, how we're spending our money or the things we're buying, but really looking at the fact that, you know, we as human beings, we just are consumers. We are constantly consuming, whether it is food and drink, to the information we're consuming, the things we're consuming when we look at social media. And really, like, I'm just fascinated with all of it, and then looking at how it affects sort of our happiness, our behaviors, our habits, and then how it does affect our spending. So I'm just looking all over the place right now.
Well, congratulations. You've been featured all over God's green earth and media outlets too prestigious to mention. Congratulations, and thank you for giving us some of your time.
Thank you so much. This was great, Bruce.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Kate Flanders is the author of The Year of Less. how I stopped shopping, gave away my belongings, and discovered life is worth more than anything you can buy in a store. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolah La, you can Airbnb your condo, but would you Turo your car when you aren't using it? I don't know. We'll look at a new platform that offers peer-to-peer car sharing. And later, lower the fees, please. Compounding is awesome when it helps your money grow. It's not the so awesome when it comes to the fees you pay. You can find me on Twitter at Bruce Selry, Facebook, Bruce Selry, Moolah La. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Airbnb might get all the headlines, but did you know you can also rent out your car through an app? It's called Turo, and it's a peer-to-peer car sharing company that could turn your car from a major cost into an engine of cash. Joining us now to tell us more is the director of Turo Canada, Cedric Mathieu. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
This idea makes me totally nervous. I like the idea because I hate underutilized capacity, and I was an early adopter on renting out my apartment, well before Airbnb. We put our apartment up on Craigslist, so I love it conceptually. But not with my car! How does this work? Tell me how this works.
Well, it's very easy. We actually made it sure that you could list your car in a very safe way on the marketplace. And so to do that, we partnered with a leading insurance company in Canada. It's called Intact Financial Corporation.
Yep.
And we designed a specific, completely new insurance product that basically covers your car during every reservation. So as a car owner, you know that whatever happens during a trip will never hurt your personal insurance or your personal premiums.
So if there is an accident, if it was my friend and it was not through Turo, that comes back to haunt me. But if it's with a Turo driver, it's completely irrelevant because my insurance company is never contacted?
Exactly. So yeah, we turned something that people were already doing but without the insurance coverage into something right. that actually was safe and that enables you to make money as a car owner, because we all know that the car costs a lot of money to own.
I have another concern. That is that people are going to get in my car and wonder why I don't clean up after my 8-year-old in the back seat, because there's goldfish there, there's Cheerios there, there's all sorts of crud in between the seats. What do you say to that?
Well, obviously,
it's a debilitating fear I face.
We obviously encourage hosts to take good care of their cars, because people renting
those
cars.
Are you implying I don't take good care of my car just because there's goldfish in there?
Probably people have some different definitions of good care. But that's something that comes up pretty easily in the and quickly in reviews. And so, of course, a car that's going to be clean and listed at a good price will have more likelihood to actually being rented. But I guess with your car, you could also make some decent money with it.
Document more than once every year. I see. I understand. How do I connect? How do I, as a host, connect with a traveler?
So it's super easy. As a host or as a car owner, you're going to go on the app, download our app, or go on our website. You're going to just list your car on the marketplace. It's going to take a few minutes. You're going to add a few photos, decide on a price for your car. And then from now on, people will actually see your car, depending on the destination they want to go to. They're going to send you a request, and then up to you to accept that request or not. And then from there, you're going to connect with them. You're going to meet with them, and they're going to be on their way with your car.
And So with Airbnb, I can put a lockbox outside my house. I give them the code and they go into my house. I don't have to be there. How does that work with a car?
So with a car, the most common interaction is really for the host and the guest to meet, because it's a very important part of the experience. And it's great to have the owner of the car walk you around the car and tell you how it works and make sure that you're really comfortable driving this car. So the in-person connection is a very important part of that. But obviously, there are some other ways, and you could also use mechanisms like a lockbox to get people access to the car key.
We're a personal finance show, so I come at this from the perspective of how people can make money. What does the average car owner make through this service?
So it's very interesting. When we look at the data for the past 12 months, on average, in Canada, active hosts have made roughly $600 per month renting their car out on Turo, which when you compare to the cost of owning a car in Canada, there are a lot of studies out there trying to explain how much it costs to own a car. It varies depending on the type of cars from $650 for a compact car to, you know, $850, $900 a month for a more premium car. And I'm not even talking about luxury cars.
And how often would they be renting their car? Is it I rented it once for a week, or I'm basically meeting travelers every single day 14 times to rent out my car for a 5-minute trip to the grocery store?
So it's really up to you. The minimum duration of a trip is 1 day on Turo, so that limits the amount of friction associated with every rental. And then it's really up to you how long you want to rent your car out for. That $600 average they gave you on a monthly basis corresponds to roughly 8 to 9 days a month of rental. So about a third of the month, your car is going to be out. The rest of the month, you're going to be driving your car. But the beauty is now it's the other travelers who are paying for your cars because, you know, you're getting $600 a month to actually cover the cost of ownership.
Apples to apples, how would the cost compare for someone who went to a traditional car rental agency and rented a four-door sedan for 24 hours? How would that compare to me if I had a traditional four-door sedan?
It obviously varies from one car to the next and from one city to the next. But on average, prices on Turo are about 30% cheaper than in traditional car rental, just because the hosts who are doing this are not doing this as a full-time job, and they don't have all the costs associated to running a car rental operation. And so they're able to price their cars pretty aggressively. And that's why you have way cheaper prices on Turo than in traditional car rental.
What piece of the action does your company take?
So we are taking a 25% commission on the price listed for the car on the platform.
Which is similar to other, you know, like an Airbnb or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, commissions vary from one marketplace to the next. The specific thing about Turo is really about the insurance, because part of that commission that we take goes towards the insurance premiums that we're paying to cover your car during the reservation, which is something that's very important in the transportation marketplace because we want everyone to feel safe.
What are the other pros and cons versus something like a Car2Go, which you can pick up and drop off in various places, or a Zipcar, which you have to return to a particular parking spot, but which you can rent for, you know, a day quite easily with a little card, and you don't have to try and schedule a time to meet with the host?
So we think the Turo model is very different from the other car sharing companies like Car2Go or Zipcar that you mentioned. We consider these companies as mobility companies, and you can basically rent a car for a very short amount of time, and that addresses the mobility needs of people living in big cities like Toronto or Montreal. Turo, as I mentioned, is more of a travel marketplace because you rent car by the day. So the average duration of a Turo trip is actually about 3.5 days. So really the use case here is someone trying to get a car to escape the city for a short getaway or to go on a vacation. So it actually, the emergence of car sharing companies and ride sharing companies helps Turo and makes Turo even more relevant, because now it's easier than ever to live without a car in a city. And when you want to get out of the city, you still need that car. And then Turo becomes the de facto solution to do that.
Who pays for fuel? How does that work?
It's the traveler who pays for fuel. So when you take the car from the host, the car is going to come with a certain amount of fuel in it, and you just have to give it back with the same amount of fuel. It's pretty easy.
What's the biggest thing about the technology of the platform that might surprise me?
I think that the biggest thing about Turo and what we spend the most time on for the past 8 years that the company has been around in the U.S. and 2 years in Canada is really the safety of it all. We spend a lot of time investing in both the insurance coverage, that's something that's very new and that's still very pioneering across Canada, but also on the overall safety of the marketplace. Mm. We screen every renter on the platform. We make sure that people are who they say they are, and we make sure that their risk level is good, and that they're going to take good care of your car. There's a whole trust system integrated in the platform that enables you to know which guests are going to take good care of your car, are going to be good drivers,
right.
And that's really what makes the whole tour experience safe and nice for everyone.
Interesting. Well, thank you for joining us to tell us about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Cedric Mathieu is the director of Turo Canada.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery. on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Millennials have something that everyone saving for retirement covets. Time. They have time. With 30 to 40 years until retirement, millennials have plenty of time to put money aside and save and save and save so their savings can compound and grow. But with decades to save, they also face decades of investment fees, potentially. 1 or 2% might not seem like much now, but over a long period of time, the financial impact of missing out on that compound growth because of fees can be huge. Joining us now is Steve Bridge. He is a money coach at Money Coaches Canada, and he joins us from North Vancouver. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Let's go through the gamut. What are the fees that investors pay? I mean, if you're a mutual fund investor, most of it can be encapsulated by the management expense ratio on a fund, but what else should people know?
Sure. Well, to start off with, Bruce, isn't it funny that you even have to ask me that question? Doesn't it seem wrong that every Canadian doesn't know exactly how much they pay in fees?
It seems like a missed opportunity. I know the answer I'm asking for my listeners, just to be clear.
It's a valid question, and it's not your listeners' fault because the industry has fought full disclosure for over 20 years. And this is one of the most important purchases someone will ever make because it dictates the quality and quantity of their retirement years.
Yeah.
Yet we don't know. So, that's my little tangent, Bruce. To answer your questions, there are sometimes fees to buy a mutual fund and sell a mutual fund, but there's always a fee to own a mutual fund.
Right. And the buy and sell are front-end load or deferred sales charges, less common, I think, today than 10 years ago, certainly.
That's right.
What have you noticed about the new CRM2 and how that has affected how people think about fees? This was a regulation that was launched not too long ago, but it is not all-inclusive.
That's correct. And it's come as a surprise to some people. Some people didn't think they paid fees. They've been told they don't pay fees. And it's a little bit misleading. And CRM2 is a step in the right direction. It's fantastic. But it doesn't include everything. As we know, it doesn't include the fund manager or portfolio manager's fee. Again, this has been fought by the industry, which is a little disheartening. But, we'll continue to beat the drum for transparency, right?
Yes, I've been beating the drum for a long time. We'll continue to beat it. We talk about compounding a lot on the upside. Like, ooh, if you, grow over years, your money grows dramatically. Where it is a problem is when you miss out on that growth because of the fees you pay. So I've asked you in advance to give us some calculations here to illustrate how much money people could be leaving on the table. So what we said is we're going to start with $100,000 in principal, annual contributions of $15,000. $1,000 a year, which for some people it's not maxing out. For other people, it seems like a huge amount of money. And start at age 30, end at age 70. So that's the kind of range here. We're assuming an investment rate of return of 5%. If you're in a mutual fund that has the average MER of 2.3%, what's the number on fees?
Okay. So I changed the number a tiny bit to go to 65. So this isn't even the whole gamut to 70. I thought, okay, someone's going to retire at 65, and then go for 20 years after that. So, end at 65, you end up with $1.2 million, Bruce, if you pay 2.3% in which is the average equity mutual fund fee. You end up with $1.2 million, which sounds fantastic, doesn't it?
It does. And then what's the number on the fees that you would have paid in that time?
That would be $458,000.
Right.
In fees plus opportunity cost, Bruce, which always has to be mentioned.
What do you mean by that?
The money that disappeared in fees didn't have the chance to grow into something bigger. So it's gone. That 2.3% is gone every year. He doesn't get a chance to grow up with his friends.
Right. So on the other end of the spectrum, there are some people who will open up an account at a discount brokerage and do the cheapest do-it-yourself version of a low-cost exchange-traded fund. Let's say that's somewhere around 20 basis points. So a tenth of the cost, one-tenth of the cost. Compare that $400,000 in fees to what that person spends.
60
grand.
$6,000. So you've just saved yourself about $400,000.
Right. So it's dramatic. Now there is a trade-off here. If you are a DIYer and you're doing this entirely yourself, you do miss out on the services of a great financial advisor. And
Absolutely.
For the record, there are great, 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 great financial advisors out
Absolutely.
There who are worth the fees that they pay. What are some things that you don't get when you go entirely DIY?
Well, you're missing out on the comprehensive planning that a good financial advisor will provide with those fees. So comprehensive financial planning might look like tax minimization, retirement planning, cash flow work, CPP, OAS advice, clawback strategies, estate planning, education planning for your kids. So that's what you're missing out on.
There are other models of which you have skin in the game on one of them, given that you're a money coach. Tell us about the money coach model. Are you fee for service or are you percentage based on assets?
No, I'm fee for service. So doesn't matter to me if you have $100,000 in the bank or $20,000 in the bank or $5 million in the bank. I will charge you based on the complexity of your situation and how much help you need.
And what would be the average invoice that you would send out to a client?
It's a range based on complexity, Bruce, but it's in the $3,500 range.
Right. So $3,500, whether they got buckets of money or very little.
Another
model is fee-based, which is some, depending on how much money you have, maybe it's 1%, maybe it's 1.25%. And the robos, what's your take on the robos?
I like them because they're investing in index funds and they don't have any skin in the game, so to speak, with regard to selling you actively managed funds. So
and
I'm a fan.
In those scenarios, what was the fee number for a robo-advisor at around 0.5%?
The fees were about $130,000, so about $320,000 less than the mutual fund.
What would you say to people to help them self-assess what model is going to be the best for them? Because certainly not everyone could be or should be a DIYer. Not everyone could be or should be someone who pays fee for service. What are the questions you would have people ask themselves to determine what's the best path for them?
Right. So know thyself, right? And it's how much you want to be involved in your investment process yourself. How much do you know? How much time are you willing to put into this? Then fine, that's maybe you're good for a DIYer, but that's a very small percentage of people. Very small.
Steve, we appreciate you making time for us to go over the fee question.
My pleasure, Bruce.
Steve Bridge is a money coach at Money Coaches Canada. He joined us from North Vancouver, British Columbia. Stay with us. Coming up later, the Moolala Questionnaire. But next, investing in cannabis. With Canada's legalization of marijuana fast approaching, we'll talk about whether or not people should be investing in pot stocks. If you have a question about money, not including cannabis, I may have the answer already for you, given that I've been writing for years and years and years for Money Sense. So I'm a money columnist for Money Sense. You can go to moneysense.ca, search for me, or better yet, search for the topic that you want to learn more about and see if me or any of my awesome colleagues over there have written something that could be helpful. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Marijuana is going to be legal in Canada soon, and investors have been rushing to pour money into shares of many different marijuana-related companies. But is Canada's marijuana boom actually a boom, or could it be a bubble? Who knows? And is there a safe way to invest in cannabis? Here to tell us more is Renee Ellison. She is the founder of Flourish, a Canadian cannabis company devoted to women. She joins us now from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You quit your job at Health Canada to get into the cannabis business. Did your friends think you were insane?
I think everyone thought I was insane, leaving a pension, leaving a steady job. I had a great life, and I went through at the time some difficult issues with family, getting sick, and you know, when you go through something like that, it really changes your perspective on life. And I realized, you know, what I really want to do is to be able to help people. And so coincidentally, at the time, I was working at Health Canada on the marijuana for medical purposes regulations as a communications lead. And I thought, hey, you know, I've learned so much about cannabis and the benefits, and I think this can really help people. And I've always been a very big user of natural, you know, medicines and, you know, essential oils, and I do meditation and all of this kind of more natural approach to health. And I thought, okay, this is something that I think I can do. And I asked, actually, you know, I also looked at my background. I had worked as a pharmacy technician, so I understood, you know, some of the protocols there. Mm-hmm. I also had worked in several government departments that had related health portfolio mandates, so I had a good kind of health background, and I understood the regulations. So it was really, for me, kind of looking at everything in my life and saying, hey, the stars are aligning, and this is something that I really think I can make a go at.
Why the focus on women? What is different when you look at it through a gender lens, and what's different about Flourish?
So the industry is very male-oriented right now because the high venture capital that's required to get into this industry, just the way the regulations are written, is that you have to basically have your facility up and running before you can get licensed. So the cost of this, I mean, we're talking millions. So for women, this seems to be an area of struggle. I've read a lot of research around that as well. So that's probably why you don't get see a lot of women founders. And I thought, you know, this is pretty unique. And also, given my background in health, one of the areas that, you know, certainly government has identified is that traditionally medicine and scientific research has been focused around men, and there's a gap there. And in this industry, I mean, we're pioneers. We have an opportunity to really get the evidence for cannabis as a whole, because we know cannabis has traditionally kind of been underground, and pharmaceuticals haven't invested in cannabis because it was always, you know, illegal. So so now we've got this new flourishing industry that is really looking at moving things in an evidence-based way, because we're recognizing we have the anecdotal information, and people have been using it, and there is some really great evidence that is coming forward, but there's still more that can be done. And so given my background, I think there's a real opportunity to be able to support women in their health.
What kind of a company is Flourish? Are you a vertically integrated grower, marketer, end-to-end, or is there a part of it that you focus on?
We are end-to-end, seed to sale.
So what will it look like when there's a retail presence? What will Flourish look like to the consumer compared to what would be offered by a competitor who didn't think through the gender lens?
Well, we will be a female-focused brand that you could either purchase through the medical distribution channel, or through like a here in Ontario would be an LCBO, so through a licensed dealer across the provinces. So we would look like any other brand, we're tailoring and customizing our strains specifically for women's needs.
And what's different? I'm sure there's something different from a consumer insight standpoint, but is there something different from a physiological standpoint?
There is a difference. Besides obvious differences, lots of differences in women. So women actually have more cannabinoid receptors found in their uterus. So they actually are more sensitive to cannabis.
So lower doses for Flourish.
Lower doses, which work better for women. And also, we know that women prefer fruitier and floral, we call them terpene profiles, which are the flavors and the scents of cannabis. We know about their uses, so they prefer to use with a partner or friend, and in the evenings typically, so not so much during the day. We understand that, you know, they also have different needs in terms of the type of strains that they prefer to use.
This is a sector that has been in focus, well, for certainly for 12 months, very, very hot sector for publicly traded companies. It's a big deal. And there are risk factors here. How do you address some of the questions around the political dynamic and what can happen provincially as the regulations change?
So what we've done over the years is just to try and remain as flexible as possible. So that means looking at kind of forward thinking, you know, and trying to anticipate where things may go. And just really kind of trying to stay light on our feet. So, I mean, we have an excellent team of seasoned experts in the industry, and they're a very diverse team. So we have a lot of different skill sets that can add to the mix of what we're looking at. So, you know, if we have a regulatory issue, I can sometimes anticipate, you know, these could be potential issues coming up. And you know, on the same side, we've got, you know, a commercial grower. So he can anticipate certain issues that could evolve around the growing conditions. So it's hard, right? Staying ahead of a moving target. Mm.
We've only got about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you, are you concerned about a pot bubble? And what I mean by that is the valuations of publicly traded stocks have gone through the roof in some cases. And I think there is a credible question about valuation, which if it were to burst, would affect lots of different companies, even if they aren't publicly traded.
Certainly with the tech bubble, we've seen this. And as we know, trends seem to be cyclical. So this is something that we are mindful, but, you know, the question is when, and maybe again, we don't know. This is a brand new industry that we've never seen before. And I think Canada is well positioned, being a leader in the world in this industry and being one of the first G8 countries to actually legalize. So I think there's time before that bubble pops. But again, if I had my crystal ball, I could give you a better answer. But
your crystal ball might be a little smoky because of, you know, some of the products. Renee, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Renee Ellison is the founder of Flourish, a Canadian cannabis company focused on women. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, what's a family office? Mostly a resource for the ultra wealthy, perhaps, but there are some things for us mere mortals to learn from that approach. We'll talk with investment advisor Emily Griffiths Hamilton. And we'll take you through the Moolah La questionnaire with Steve Bridge. Let's talk book club. I probably would expect that most of you read fiction at your book club, but how about changing it up and bringing some Moolah La into your book club? You can find and order either of my two personal finance books online. Maybe you can invite me to come and talk to your book club afterwards. Who knows? Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
As an entrepreneur, selling the company you successfully built is cause for celebration. But after all the champagne bottles are drained, a new Porsche is parked in the garage, and you've taken the kids to Disney World a couple of times, you might realize there's a bit of a difference between running a company worth millions and having millions. Taking care of that wealth can be a business in and of itself, which is why some people look to family offices for help. Here to tell us more is investment advisor Emily Griffiths Hamilton with Griffiths Hamilton Family Office Advisors. She joins us from Vancouver. Hello there.
Hey, hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
I am great. What is a family office? How would you define that?
Yeah, I would say a family office is a term used to describe how a family organizes itself once it's amassed a certain amount of wealth. And like your intro says, it's often as a result of selling a business, or sometimes it's wealth that's accumulated from the business over the years.
And what is the level of wealth at which a family office makes sense?
That all depends on the needs and the objectives of the family. So we see them anywhere from, let's say, the $25 million range and above.
And above. Okay. And what sort of, so you've got those assets. What are some of the services that would fall under a family office?
Right. Well, the services actually fall out from the result of a four-step process that I would recommend, and that would start with one, recognizing the financial freedom and first starting with just investing the assets to ensure liquidity, safety of capital, and preservation of that wealth. And then step two is financial investment management, and that's usually when you're building this office in the sort of 2 to 3 year range, you're adding diversification and growth in your investments. And then the third is reflection. So like you say, you popped the champagne, you've got the Porsche, you've taken the kids to Disneyland a couple of times, but now things are settling down and you're starting to reflect on what your values are and your family values, what your vision is for the family, and then really what the purpose of this wealth is for the future. And then finally, out of that comes the structure and the services. So there's really two parts to that, and I break those down into the quantitative part and the qualitative part. And the quantitative factors include managing the financial matters like investing, tax planning, financial planning, insurance, but also, and perhaps most importantly and sometimes forgotten about, the qualitative factors. And that's managing the family matters. And those include...
You mean like whose turn it is to do the dishes and why did you borrow my car and not fill up the gas, that stuff?
It could be a little bit like that. That gets pretty specific, but I'd say the three things there would be managing their expectations, the family members' expectations. They're preparing the upcoming generation for their potential future roles and responsibility, and then reducing family conflict by solving today some of tomorrow's predictable problems.
You would see some very interesting family dynamics, I assume. What would you say is similar with high net worth families that you work with and different from families who don't have $25 million in assets?
I would say similar in all cases is breakdown in communication in the family and how they relate to the financial wealth. On the different side, I don't see a lot of difference. I think at the end of the day, people are all human. There's probably just a greater need to be even more clear about who you are and what you want to achieve and what you want this money to do for you.
It also seems to me that with a sum that is that large, you're less likely to kick the kid out of the nest than if you were a family where, you know, as soon as they graduate from post-secondary education, they're on their own. Like they're, because I'm busy trying to save for my retirement and pay off the debt they might have put me in to help pay for their education. Whereas if you've got significant wealth, if you're not funding them, there may be still the talk of what happens on an inheritance that has them connected to the family financially in a way that wouldn't be there if they didn't have big assets.
Right. So I think that you are absolutely right. When there is an absolute need, you have no choice but to go out and make your own way in the world. The difference, though, is that the families that have these conversations and think about this beforehand, that they don't want the child to become dependent on what I sometimes call the family bank or become entitled, then that's where the family sits and has the specific conversations about what their values are and what their priorities are. So if that a family's priority is to raise independent children that are independent, leading purposeful lives, then that's a conversation. And then how they relate to the money is explicitly laid out and agreed to often by family members. So said that generation coming up with a sense of entitlement, those families rather focus on raising that next generation to be stewards of the wealth, for not only themselves, but for future generations and for a specific purpose. So it might be for continuing education or perhaps investment funds for entrepreneurial ventures and that.
Right. How do you help them navigate how those values play out in dollars and cents? So do you help them say, you know what, 30% of the nest egg is going to philanthropy upon death of the matriarch? Or how do you help them navigate those conversations?
So those conversations start with family meetings. So I specifically have families gather and I sit in front of up to three generations at a time and facilitate a meeting where I first get the families to focus on their values, what their priorities are, or what their beliefs are. And then we move from there into defining what it is they want to achieve with this financial wealth. And in those meetings, so it's as much about the meeting and the conversation they're having as the process of going through the meeting, because many of these families have never done this before, never gathered like a group to have these kinds of conversations. So this is new to them, and they're learning this. And then once they get through the who they are and what they want to achieve, then we sit down, and again, I'm facilitating. I'm not telling them what to do, but I do encourage them that there are specific policies that they can put in place today to quite literally solve many of tomorrow's predictable problems and reduce conflict.
Interesting. I think there's a great model for regular families to listen to what you have said and apply it to them, even if they don't have anywhere near the dollars that you're talking about. Emily, thank you very much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you. I hope that was helpful.
It's great. Emily Griffiths-Hamilton is an investment advisor. Her focus is on family offices, and she joined us from Vancouver. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our set series of questions about money, a little bit about life. Steve Bridge is here to take our questionnaire. He's a money coach with Money Coaches Canada, and he joins us from North Van, British Columbia. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great, Bruce. Thank you.
How would you describe your money personality?
Oh, frugal.
Frugal. And why do you think that that is?
Why do I think it is? Because I'm always looking to the future. I try to say to myself, live like no one else now so I can live like no one else later.
And was this always the way you managed your money, even from when you were a kid?
Yes. Yes, it was. I don't know why.
Who was your money mentor?
You know, perhaps my father. I didn't really have one. You know, we didn't talk about money much in my household. But the one thing he said was, don't put your money in the bank, buy the bank.
Oh, like literally go and buy an entire bank?
That's right. So, you know, I bought two or three banks. It's worked out quite well.
Good for you. Good for you. What is one thing that you, even given what you do for a living, what's one thing you worry about when it comes to money?
To be honest with you, I don't have any money worries because I've been self-educating for 15 years, and I feel really good about my plan. That doesn't mean I'm not a work in progress on certain things, like falling for insanely good sales or deals, but I feel pretty good about my path.
Ooh, what category are you susceptible to falling for exceptionally good sales or deals?
It's a pretty wide gamut. It has to be a pretty great deal. But most recently, Bruce, it would be a $20 slow cooker from Canadian Tire.
A slow cooker? You didn't get an Instant Pot? What, a slow cooker? That's like 2004. Who buys those?
I'm a little behind.
I guess. Thinking back, what was your worst financial mistake ever?
Oh, my worst financial mistake is also my best one. Back in the early 2000s, I had saved some money and I didn't know what to do with it. So I went to my mom and I said, Mom, what should I do? And she said, go see my financial advisor. He's great. So I went to see him. He lived in a very nice house. So I thought he must be very good. And he showed me some fancy graphs where everything only went up. I gave him my money. And 5 years later, it was worth $500 less than when I started. I thought to myself, I can do at least that well. So I started to educate myself, read books, magazines, etc., and then I decided I wanted to help others with their money.
What is your favorite personal finance book, blog, or insight out there? What was a pivotal one for you?
Oh, I really enjoy reading Mr. Money Mustache.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got some really practical tips and great thoughts on frugal living and how much we actually need as opposed to want.
What is one money topic you could write about, talk about every single day without getting sick of it?
Housing. Mm. Housing without a doubt. You know, so many people think it's a golden goose, but the combined expenses, you know, mortgage payments, renovations, maintenance, repairs, taxes, can make it a drag on your long-term financial well-being.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Just one, Bruce?
Just one.
Okay. It's related to my last one. I would snap people out of the belief that a real estate investment is going to make you rich. Mm.
you do the math for all the expenses, it may not add up to what you think.
Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bruce.
Steve Bridge is money coach with Money Coaches Canada. He joined us from a housing crazy market, Vancouver, British Columbia. That is our program for today. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can drop us a line at ask@moolala.ca. You can also tweet at me. At Bruce Selry is the Twitter handle. Moolala, Bruce Selry Moolala is Facebook. If you want to get more of Moolala, head over to our website, moolala.ca. You can search this podcast and listen to the whole thing, beginning to end. You can also search specific segments. And if you do that on iTunes, you can have it set to come into your device every single week. Thanks very much for joining us today. Have a great day.